shaping our personalities. Blomqvist had no trouble coming up with hypotheses to challenge Hilda's findings, and he could also identify problems with how the research material was to be interpreted. Yet he found that the article made for interesting reading. He learned about some extraordinary cases of identical twins who had grown up in different families and only met as adults, but were strikingly similar, not just in appearance, but also in behavior.
In the U.S., there were the so-called Jim twins of Ohio.
Unaware of each other's existence, yet both became chain smokers of Salem cigarettes, bit their fingernails, suffered from bad headaches, had carpentry workbenches in their garage, named their dogs Toy, got married twice to women with the same name, had sons they christened James Allen with two L's and James Allen with one L, and God knows what else. Blomqvist could see why the tabloids had become excited, but he himself was not all that impressed. He knew how easy it was to become fixated by similarities and coincidences, how the sensational always sticks in the mind and stands out at the expense of the ordinary, which, maybe precisely because it is so ordinary, tells us something more significant about the real world. But Blomqvist did see that all these studies on twins resulted in a paradigm shift for epidemiological science. The research community began to believe more in the power that genes have over us and in their intricate interplay with environmental factors. Earlier, especially in the 1960s and 70s, more weight had been given to the impact of social considerations. There was a prevailing notion that to grow up in a certain environment, or to be raised in a particular way, would inevitably produce a specific type of individual. Many scientists dreamed of being able to prove this, in order, perhaps, to determine how to produce better, happier people. It was one of the reasons why so many research projects with twins were initiated at that time, some of which Hilda, in evasive terms, described as tendentious and radical. It was there that Blomqvist suddenly sat up and continued his research with renewed energy. He had no idea whether he was on the right track, yet he kept digging, including by searching combinations of the words tendentious and radical in the context of twins research. That is how he came across the name Roger Stafford. Stafford was an American psychoanalyst and psychiatrist who had been a professor at Yale. He had worked closely with Freud's daughter Anna and was said to be charismatic and charming. There were pictures of him with Jane Fonda, Henry Kissinger, and Gerald Ford, and he looked a little like a film star himself. But his main claim to fame was less flattering. Tendentious and radical was precisely the point. In September 1989, the Washington Post disclosed that, in the late 1960s, Stafford had established close relationships with the female managers of five adoption agencies in New York and Boston. Two of the women had affairs with him, and there may have been promises of marriage. Not that he was reliant on that. Stafford was quite an authority at the time. In one of his books, The Egoistic Child, he claimed that identical twins thrive better and become more independent if they grow up apart. This conclusion was later debunked, but by then it had become established among therapists on the East Coast. It was agreed that these women would contact Stafford as soon as twins were referred to them for adoption. The children were then placed in consultation with him. A total of 46 babies were involved, 28 identical and 18 fraternal twins. None of the families was informed that their adopted son or daughter was a twin, or even that they had a sibling. The adoptive parents, on the other hand, were required to allow Stafford and his team to examine the children once a year and make them undertake a series of personality tests. Before long, one of the managers, a woman by the name of Rita Bernard, noticed that Stafford insisted on placing twins with sets of parents who were utterly different from each other in terms of status, education, religious affiliation, temperament, personality, ethnicity, and in their methods of child-rearing. Instead of putting the twins' interests first, Stafford seemed bent on pursuing research into heredity and environment, she said. Stafford did not deny that he was engaged in scientific work. He saw it as an excellent opportunity to improve our understanding of how we are formed as individuals. He said that his research would become an inestimable scientific resource. He vehemently denied that he was not prioritizing the interests of the child, but for reasons of integrity, he refused to make his material public. He donated it to the Yale Child Studies Center with the proviso that researchers and the public should have access to it only in 2078, when all those involved would be long dead. He did not, he said, want to exploit the fate of those twins. That sounded noble, but there were critics who claimed that he declared the material confidential because it had fallen short of his expectations. Most agreed that the experiment was deeply unethical, and that Stafford had deprived siblings of the joy of growing up together. A fellow psychiatrist from Harvard even compared his activities with Josef Mengele's experiments on twins at Auschwitz. Stafford retaliated, wildly and proudly, with two or three lawyers, and the debate came to an end not long after. When Stafford died in 2001, he was buried, with a certain amount of pomp and circumstance, and in the presence of a number of celebrities. Some fine obituaries were published in the specialist press and newspapers. The experiment did not tarnish his memory to any significant extent, perhaps because the children who had been so brutally separated from each other had all come from the lower strata of society. That was nothing unusual in those days, as Blomqvist knew only too well. One could inflict abuses on ethnic and other minorities in the name of science and for the good of society, and get away with it. For that reason, Blomqvist was unwilling to dismiss Stafford's experiment as an isolated episode, and looked further into the history. He noted that Stafford had been to Sweden in the 1970s and 80s. There were pictures of him with Lars Malm, Birgitte Edberg, Liselott Seder, and Martin Steinberg, the leading psychoanalysts and sociologists of the day. At the time, nothing was known about Stafford's experiments with twins, and he may have had other reasons for visiting Sweden, but Blomqvist kept digging, thinking of Salander all along. She, too, was a twin, a fraternal twin to a nightmare sister named Camilla. He knew the authorities had attempted to examine her when she was little, and she had hated it. He also thought about Leo Mannheimer and his high IQ score, and about Eleanor Hjort's suggestion that he might have been born into the gypsy community. He became absorbed by an article in Nature magazine which explained how one fertilized egg splits in the womb and results in identical twins. Then he got up from his desk and stood motionless for a minute or two, muttering to himself. He rang Lotta von Canterborg again and told her what he suspected. In fact, he took a chance and presented his new wild theory as fact.
"That sounds completely crazy," she said.
"I know. But will you tell Hilda, if she gets in touch? Tell her that the situation is critical."
"I will,"
Lotta said. Blomqvist went to bed with his mobile next to him on the bedside table. But no one called. Even so, he hardly slept, and now he was back at his computer. He was looking into the people Stafford had met on his trips to Sweden, and to his surprise, he came across Holger Palmgren's name. Palmgren and sociology professor Martin Steinberg had been working together on a criminal case more than two decades ago. Blomqvist hardly thought that this was significant. Stockholm is a small place after all. People are always running into each other. Still, he made a note of Steinberg's telephone number and address in Lidingö, and carried on searching into his background. But his concentration was drifting. He was of two minds. Should he send an encrypted message to Salander and tell her what he had found? Should he confront Mannheimer to see if he was on the right track? He had another espresso and suddenly missed Marlin. In no time at all she had found her way back into his life like a force of nature. He went into the bathroom and stepped on the scale. He had gained weight, so he needed to do something about that. And he should get his hair cut. It was sticking out in all directions, and he tried to smooth it down. But then he said out loud, "To hell with it," and went back to his desk to call, email, and text Salander. In the end he wrote into their shared file on his computer, "Get in touch. I think I've found something." Something about his message did not feel quite right. The word, think. Salander was not keen on half measures. He corrected it. "I've found something," and hoped it was true. Then he went to his wardrobe, put on a newly ironed cotton shirt, and went out, down Bellmansgatan to the Tunnelbana station on Mariatorget. On the platform he took out his notes from the night before and went through them one more time. He looked at his question marks and speculations. Was he going mad? He looked at the digital display above him and saw that a train was about to arrive. At that moment his mobile rang. It was Lotta von Canterborg, and she was breathing hard.
"She called," she said.
"Hilda,
she told me that what you said about Leo Mannheimer sounded crazy, that it couldn't possibly be right."
"I see."
"But she wants to meet you," she said. "She'd like to tell you what she does know. Right now she's..."
"Don't tell me over the phone." Blomqvist suggested that they meet right away at Café Bar on St. Paulsgatan, and hurried back up the station steps. Chapter 14. June 21st. Oblansky was in an apartment in Aspudden, surrounded by old-fashioned furniture and talking to Maj-Britt Turell, the woman who, according to Salander, had visited Palmgren a few weeks before. She was an old lady with probably the best intentions, Poblansky thought, but there was something odd about her. Not only was she fiddling nervously with the Danish pastries on the coffee table, she also seemed surprisingly forgetful and disorganized for someone who had spent so many years working as a medical secretary.
"I'm not quite sure what I gave him," she said. "I'd just heard so much about the girl and thought it was time he got the full story, about how appallingly she was treated."
"So you gave Palmgren the original papers?"
"I suppose I did. The professor's practice has been closed for ages, and I have no idea what became of all the medical records, but I had some papers given to me unofficially by Professor Caldeen."
"Secretly, you mean?"
"You could put it like that."
"Important documents, then?"
"I suppose so."
"Wouldn't you have kept copies or scanned them into a computer?"
"You would think so, but I..."
Boblansky said nothing. It seemed like the right moment to keep quiet. But Terrell did not finish her sentence and went on picking even more nervously at her pastries.
"You haven't, by any chance," Boblansky said.
"What?"
"Had a visit from someone, or a phone call about these papers? Is that maybe what's making you a bit anxious right now?"
"Absolutely not," Terrell said, a little too fast and a little too nervously. Boblansky got to his feet. It was high time now. He looked at her with his most wistful smile, which he was well aware could make a deep impression on people who were wrestling with their conscience.
"In that case, I'll leave you in peace," he said. "Oh, really?"
"Just to be on the safe side, I'll call a taxi and have you taken to a nice cafe in town. This is so important and serious that I believe you need a bit of time to think. Don't you agree, Fru Turell?" Then he handed her his business card and went out to his car. December, 1.5 years earlier. On this particular day, Dan Brody was playing with the Klaus Ganz Quintet at the A-Train Jazz Club in Berlin. Years had gone by. He was 35 years old, had cut off his long hair and no longer wore an earring. He had started to wear grey suits. He could be mistaken for an office worker, and he liked it that way. It was some sort of early midlife crisis, he supposed. He was fed up with touring, but he had no choice. He had not managed to put away any savings, and he owned nothing of value. No apartment, no car, nothing. Any likelihood of a breakthrough, of becoming rich and famous, was long gone. He was never the star, even if he was invariably the most talented musician on stage, and he always had work, albeit for less and less money. It was ever harder to make a living as a jazz musician, and maybe he was no longer playing with the same passion as once he did. He no longer worked at his music all that often. He managed fine without it. During the downtime when he was travelling, instead of practising for hours each day as he used to, he now read. He devoured books and did not tend to socialise. He could not stand idle chatter or the bawling and buzz in bars and clubs, and he felt far better when he drank less. All in all, he was cleaning himself up, and increasingly he yearned for a normal life, a wife and a home, a steady job, a measure of security. Over the years he had tried just about every drug, and had had plenty of love affairs and casual relationships, but there always seemed to be something missing. Music had been his solace, though when this no longer revived his spirits, he began to wonder if he had taken the wrong path in life. Maybe he should have become a teacher. He had recently had an overwhelming experience at his old music college in Boston. He had been asked to lead a workshop on Django Reinhardt, and the prospect had scared him half to death. He was sure that speaking in public was beyond him, that his lack of stage presence was one of the reasons the record companies had not wanted to invest in him. But he agreed to do it anyway and set about preparing down to the last detail. He told himself he just needed to stick to his script, a lot of music and little talk. But when he stood up there in front of 200 students, he went weak at the knees. He was shaking all over, incapable of uttering a single word, and only after what seemed like an eternity did he manage to say, "And there I was, thinking I'd be the cool guy coming back to my alma mater. Instead I'm standing here like a complete idiot." It was not even meant as a joke. More like the desperate truth. But the students laughed, so he told them about Django and Stefan Grappelli and the Quintet du Haut Club de France. He talked about club life and its ups and downs, and about how there were so few written sources. He played minor swing and nuage, and variations on solos and riffs, and became bolder and bolder. All sorts of ideas came to him, some comical, some serious. He found himself saying that Django had been doomed to ruin. During the Hitler years he was at risk of being deported to a death camp for being Roma, that he was saved by a Nazi, of all people, an officer in the Luftwaffe who loved his music. He ultimately died in France on May 16, 1953, after a brain hemorrhage while walking from the railway station in Avon to his house. "He was a great man," Dan said. "He changed my life." Silence. He was in limbo. But then, seconds later, there was thunderous applause. The students stood up and whooped, and Dan went home astonished and happy. He had carried the memory with him, and sometimes, even now on tour in Germany, he would make a few comments between numbers, or tell an anecdote which made the audience laugh, though it was not he who was centre stage. That often gave him more pleasure than his solos, perhaps because it was something new. When he did not hear from the school again, he was disappointed. He had imagined how the teachers and professors would be talking about him, saying, "Now there's someone who can really fire up our students." But no further invitations came, and he was too proud, and too timid to get in touch to say how happy he would be to return. He failed to grasp that this was one of his problems, that he lacked get-up-and-go. The school's silence was painful, and afterwards he became withdrawn and performed with little enthusiasm. It was 9:20 p.m. on Friday, December 8th, and the bar was full. The audience was better dressed and classier than usual, perhaps also less engaged. "Probably finance people," he thought. He had met Wall Street types who treated him like a servant. There seemed to be a lot of wealth in the room, and that depressed him. Sure, there were times when he did pretty well for himself. After the first few lean years in America, he had never gone hungry, but even when he had money, it simply ran through his fingers. He decided to ignore the audience and focus on the music, even though the first set felt routine. Then came Stella by Starlight, a tune he had played 1,000 times and where he knew he could shine. He took the second-to-last solo just before Klaus Ganz himself and closed his eyes. The piece was in B-flat, but instead of following the 2-5-1 progression, he played almost entirely outside the key. By his own standards, it was not the most dazzling solo, but it was not bad, and he heard someone applaud spontaneously as he began to play. When he looked up to show his appreciation, he met the eye of a young woman in an elegant red dress, wearing a sparkling green necklace. She was blonde and slender, and there was something fox-like about her beautiful features. She was probably one of the money people, he thought, but there was nothing blasé or disinterested about her. In fact, she was rapt, and gazing intently at him. He could not recall any woman ever having looked at him like that before, not a stranger, and certainly not an upper-class beauty. But more extraordinary was the sense of intimacy. It was as if the woman was watching a dear friend. She appeared dazed and enchanted, and towards the end of his solo she mouthed something effusive, as if she knew him. Her face was wreathed in smiles, and she shook her head. There were even tears in her eyes. After the set she approached the stage, more reserved now. Perhaps he had hurt her feelings by not acknowledging her enthusiasm. Nervously she fingered her necklace as she looked at his hands and his guitar. She gave the impression of being puzzled, and he felt a sudden affection for her, a protective instinct. He climbed down from the stage and smiled at her. She laid a hand on his shoulder and said to him in Swedish, "You were incredible. I knew you played the piano, but this was magical. It was insanely good, Leo." "My name isn't Leo," he said. Salander knew that she and her sister had figured on a list kept by the Registry for the Study of Genetics and Social Environment. The organization's existence was known to only a few, but it was part of the State Institute for Human Genetics in Uppsala, which until 1958 had been known as the State Institute for Racial Biology. There were 16 other people on the list, the majority older than Lisbeth and Camilla. They had the letters MZA or DZA next to their names. Salander understood that MZ stood for monozygotic, in other words, identical twins. DZ stood for fraternal twins, and the letter A referred to apart, as in raised apart. She soon worked out that they were twins who had grown up separately in accordance with a carefully devised plan. She and Camilla, unlike the others, were labelled DZ failed A. All the rest of the twins had been separated at an early age. The results of a series of intelligence and personality tests were recorded beneath their names. Two names stood out, Leo Mannheimer and Daniel Brolin. They were described as mirror-image twins and quite exceptional. Their test results were consistent, and on a number of counts they were outstanding. They were said to have been born into the gypsy community. One note, initialled M.S., said, "Highly intelligent and extremely musical. To some extent, child prodigies, but lacking initiative. Inclined to doubt and depression, possibly also psychoses. Both have suffered from paracusis, auditory hallucinations. Loners, but with an ambivalent attitude to their isolation. Perhaps drawn to it. Both speak of a strong sense of missing something and an intense loneliness. Both show empathy. Neither shows signs of aggression, apart from the occasional fit of anger triggered by loud noises. Remarkable scores, even for creativity. Excellent verbal skills, yet low self-esteem. Somewhat better in L, for obvious reasons, but not by as much as one would expect. Perhaps due to difficult relationship with mother, who has not bonded as we had hoped." That last sentence made Salander feel sick. She was not impressed by their other character assessments either, especially not the rubbish written about her and Camilla. Camilla was very beautiful, if somewhat cold and narcissistic. Somewhat. She remembered how Camilla had gazed at the psychologists with her doe-like eyes. It obviously turned their heads. Nonetheless, there were a few details in the material which could be useful and might provide her with a lead. Among other things, there was a line about unfortunate circumstances having required the authorities to inform Leo's parents in the strictest confidence. No indication was given as to what information they had passed on, but it might have been about the project itself. That would be interesting. Salander had gotten hold of the documents by hacking into the computer system of the State Institute for Human Genetics and creating a bridge between the network and the intranet of the Registry for the Study of Genetics and Social Environment. It was an advanced exercise which had taken hours of work. She knew full well that there were not many others who could have managed to pull off that sort of hack, especially with so little preparation time. She had hoped to strike gold, but the parties involved must have been extremely cautious. She did not find a single name for those responsible, only initials, including H.K. and M.S. She decided that the files about Daniel and Leo were her best hope. They were incomplete. Most of the material was missing or had been archived in a different way, but she was keen to study what remained. Someone had put a question mark next to Mannheimer's name and then done a not very good job of erasing it. Daniel Brolin appeared to have emigrated with the ambition of becoming a guitarist. He had taken a one-year course at the Berklee College of Music in Boston, financed by a scholarship, since which all contact with him was lost. He had probably changed his name. Mannheimer had studied at the Stockholm School of Economics. There was a later note on him, "Very bitter after breaking up with a woman of his own social class. First dreams of violence. A risk? Renewed attack of paracusis?" Then there was a decision, again initialled M.S., which looked recent, announcing that the registry was to be officially closed. "Project 9 to be terminated. Mannheimer, a cause for concern," it said. Since Salander had been in prison, unable to research Mannheimer or those around him, she had asked Blomqvist to take a closer look. He'd been hopeless lately, fussing about her like some sort of father figure. Sometimes all she'd wanted to do was tear his clothes off and pull him onto her prison mattress just to shut him up. But as a journalist he was indefatigable, and sometimes, she reluctantly admitted, he did spot things she herself had missed, which is why she had deliberately not told him everything. Blomqvist would see more clearly if she let him investigate without his mind already being made up. She would ring him shortly and come to grips with the whole situation. She was sitting on a bench on Flötvägen in Fallholmen, her laptop connected to her mobile, and looked up at the grey-green tower blocks, whose colour was changing in the sunlight. She was wearing a leather jacket and black jeans, not the right clothes for a muggy day. Valholmen was often described as a ghetto. Cars burned at night, gangs of youths roamed about and mugged people. A rapist was said to be at large, and there was often chatter in the press about a community in which nobody dared to talk to the police. But right now the place seemed idyllic. A small group of women in veils were sitting with a picnic basket on the lawn in front of the tower blocks. A couple of small boys played football. Two men stood by the front entrance, spraying water with a hose and laughing like children. Salander wiped a drop of sweat from her forehead and kept on working with her deep neural network. It was tough, just as she had anticipated. The video sequence from the ticket gate at Hornstull Tunnelbana station was too short and too blurred, and the body was masked by other passengers coming up from the platform, and the face was at no point visible. It was evidently a young man, had been wearing a baseball cap and sunglasses. His head was bent forward. Salander could not even measure how broad his shoulders were. All she had was the distinctive splayed movement of his fingers and a jerky, dysmetric gesture of his right hand. She had no way of knowing how characteristic they were. It might have been a nervous reaction, an anomaly in his usual pattern of movement, but there was a striking spasmodic irregularity which was now being analysed in the nodes in her network and compared to a sequence she'd uploaded of a young man jogging past her on a training circuit 40 minutes earlier. There were correlations between the patterns of movement, and that was encouraging, but it was not enough. She needed to capture the runner in a situation more comparable to the one in the Tunnelbana station. Every so often, therefore, she looked up at the lawn and the paved path along which the young man had disappeared. There was no sign of him for the time being, so she scrolled through her emails and messages. Blomqvist had written to say that he had found something. She was tempted to call him, but it would be disastrous to lose her concentration now. She needed to be prepared. Occasionally, she glanced over towards the path. After 15 minutes, the young man reappeared in the distance. He was tall, had a professional runner's gait, and was also extremely thin. But that was irrelevant to her. All she was interested in was his right arm, the irregular jerk in the upward drive and the splayed movement of the fingers. She filmed him with her mobile and got instant feedback. The correlation was less pronounced, maybe because the runner was beginning to feel fatigue or because it had not been adequate in the first place. It might be a long shot, but it was still a reasonable supposition. The man in the video sequence was one of the few who were impossible to identify after Jamal Chowdhury's death. There were obvious similarities to the young man now approaching. If her suspicions were confirmed, this would also account for Faria's silence during questioning. Salander needed more video material. She stuffed her laptop into her bag, got up from the bench, and called out. The runner slowed his steps and squinted at her in the sunlight. She pulled a hip flask of whiskey from an inside pocket of her jacket, took a slug, and staggered sideways. The young man seemed unconcerned, but he stopped and stood there panting.
"Jesus, you can run," Salander said, her speech slurred.
He did not answer. He looked as though he wanted to be rid of her and get in the entrance door, but she was not going to give up so easily.
"Can you do this?"
she said, making a movement with her hand.
"Why?"
She had no good answer to that, so she took a step towards him.
"Because I want you to?"
"Are you stupid or something?"
She said nothing. She just glared at him with dark eyes. That seemed to scare him, so she decided to press her advantage. She lurched towards him with a threatening swagger and growled,
"What was that?"
Then the man did move his hand as she wanted, either because he was scared or because he thought it was the quickest way to extricate himself. He ran off into his building without noticing that she had filmed him on her mobile. She stood there and looked at her laptop and watched as the nodes in her network were activated. Everything became clear. She had scored a hit, a correlation in the asymmetry of the fingers, nothing which would stand up in court, but enough to convince her that she was right. She walked towards the front entrance of the building. She did not know how she would gain access, but it turned out to be easy. The door gave way with a firm shove of her shoulder, and she found herself in a shabby stairwell where everything looked either broken or dilapidated. It reeked of urine and cigarette smoke, and the lift was out of order. The walls were grey and covered with graffiti, visible thanks to the dim sunlight shining into the ground floor. But there were no windows in the stairwell and few functioning lights. It was stuffy and close, and the steps were covered in litter. Salander climbed the stairs slowly, focusing intently on the laptop balanced on her left arm. She paused on the third floor and sent the analysis of the hand motion to Bublansky and his fiancée, Farah Sharif, who was a professor of computer sciences, and also to Giannini. On the fourth floor she put the laptop into her bag and looked at the nameplates. Furthest to the left was K. Kazi, Khalil Kazi. She straightened up and took a deep breath. Khalil was nothing much to worry about, but Giannini had heard that his older brothers came regularly to see him. Salander knocked at the door and heard footsteps. The door opened and Khalil stared at her, apparently no longer frightened.
"Hi," she said. "Now what? I want to show you something. A film."
"What kind of film?"
"You'll see," she said.
He let her in. It seemed a little too easy, and soon she realized why. Khalil was not alone. Bashir Kazi, she recognized him from her research, stared at her disdainfully. This was going to be as much of an aggravation as she had feared. December, 1.5 years earlier. Dan Brody was baffled. The woman simply refused to believe that he was not that Leo guy. She fiddled with her necklace and played with her hair and said she would understand if he wanted to keep a low profile. She reminded him that she had always said he deserved better.
"You don't seem to understand how amazing you are, Leo," she said. "You never have. No one at Alfred Ogren does, and certainly not Madeline."
"Madeline?"
"Madeline's a total fool to choose Ivar over you. That's just so dumb. Ivar's a fat dickhead and a loser."
He thought she had a childlike way of speaking, but perhaps he was out of touch with modern Swedish. She was also nervous. There was quite a commotion around them, people pushing past to buy drinks at the bar. Klaus and the other band members came to ask if Dan wanted to tag along for dinner. He shook his head and looked again at the woman. She was standing strangely close to him. Her breasts were heaving, and he caught a whiff of her perfume. She was very beautiful. It was like a dream. A nice dream, he thought, although he was not entirely sure. He was bewildered. At the back of the club, a glass broke. A man started shouting, and that made Dan grimace.
"I'm sorry," the woman said. "Maybe you and Ivar are still buddies."
"I don't know an Ivar," he said sharply.
The woman looked at him in such despair that he regretted it. He felt that he would say anything she wanted, that he was called Leo and knew Madeline, and that Ivar was a dickhead. He did not want to disappoint her. He wanted her to be as happy and excited as she had been during his solo.
"I'm sorry," he said.
"That's okay."
He stroked her hair. He was shy and reserved by nature, but tonight he wanted to pretend, if only for a short while. So he went along with it. He was Leo, or rather he no longer denied it. He packed his guitar in its case and suggested they go for a drink somewhere quieter. They walked down Pestalozzi-Strasse. He had to be careful what he said. Every word was a potential trap. Sometimes he thought she had found him out. At others he thought she was playing along too. Was she not looking critically at his suit and shoes? His clothes, which until recently had seemed elegant, now felt cheap and ill-fitting. Was she toying with him? And yet she had known that he was Swedish. These days almost no one knew about his origins. They went into a small bar along the street and ordered margaritas. He let her talk, and that gave him some clues. He still did not know her name, and he dared not ask, but she was apparently running, or helping to run, a pharmaceutical fund at Deutsche Bank.
"Can you imagine what a step-up that is after all the crappy jobs Ivar gave me?"
He made a note of Ivar. Ivar, who might have been called Ogren, as in Alfred Ogren Securities, where the woman had been working until recently, and where there was also someone named Malin Frode, whom she regarded as a rival.
"I heard that you and Malin have been seeing a bit of each other," she said.
He answered, "Not really, in fact, not at all." He gave evasive answers to almost every question, although he was quite open about how he came to be playing with Klaus Ganz. "Through contacts," he said. He'd been recommended by Till Brunner and Chet Harold. "I played with them in New York. Klaus took a chance on me." The truth was it was no gamble for any jazz band to hire him. He knew that much, at least, about his talents.
"But the guitar, Leo? You're incredible. You must have been playing for years. When did you start?
In my teens, he said.
I thought only the grand piano and violin were good enough for Viveka.
I played on the sly.
The piano must have been useful, though. I recognized the harmonies when you played your solo, not that I'm an expert. But I remember hearing you at Thomas and Irene's. It was the same feeling, the same vibe.
The same feeling on a piano? What on earth did she mean? He wanted to ask, to have more clues, but he did not dare. He mostly kept quiet or simply smiled and nodded. Occasionally he would make a harmless remark or tell her about something he had read somewhere, such as, he had no idea how this came up, that the sleeper shark can live to the age of 400 years because it exists in slow motion.
That's dreary, she said.
And long, he said in a protracted drawl, and that made her laugh. It did not take much to make her laugh, and he became more and more confident. He even dared to answer a question about where he thought the market was heading,
now that valuations are so full and with interest rates low.
Up, he said.
Or down.
She found that funny, too, and he felt he was discovering something new, that he enjoyed playing a role, that it added something to his personality and helped him to enter a world which had until now been closed to him, a world of money and opportunity. It may have been the drinks. It may have been the way she was looking at him. He talked and talked, and was pleased with what emerged. More than anything, he was glad to be seen with her. He loved her refinement, which was impossible to describe and was so much more than just clothes, jewellery, and shoes. It came out in small expressions and gestures, her slight lisp, her ease in talking to the barman. Her poise seemed to give him status. He looked at her hips and legs and breasts and knew he wanted her. He kissed her in the middle of a sentence. He was more forward than he would ever have been as Dan Brody. Outside the bar, he pressed his groin against her. At her hotel, the Adlon Kempinski, next to the Brandenburg Gate, he took her, hard and confidently. He was no longer an inhibited lover. She said wonderful things about him afterwards, and he said wonderful things about her, too. He felt happy, happy like a fraudster who has pulled off a scam, but happy all the same. Maybe also a little bit in love. Not only with her, but with his new self, too. He couldn't sleep. He wanted to Google the names she had given him to try to understand, but he resisted the temptation. He wanted to experience that on his own. He thought of sneaking off at first light, but she looked so lovely in her sleep, clean and clear, as if she were a superior being even in her dreams. She had a red mark on her shoulder. He liked every little blemish. Just before 6 a.m. he wrapped his arms around her, whispered a thank you in her ear, and said that he had to go. To a meeting. She mumbled that she understood and gave him her business card. Her name was Julia Danbury. He promised to call. Soon, very soon. He dressed, took his guitar, and left the hotel. He started looking up Alfred Ogren's securities on his mobile during the taxi ride back to his own hotel. The CEO of the company was indeed Ivar Ogren. He really did look like a dickhead, a smug creep with double chins and small watery eyes. But that was immaterial. Right underneath his picture was one of Leo Mannheimer, head of research and partner. He could not believe it. It was insane. It was his picture. The man in the photograph was so like him that it made his head spin. He took off his seatbelt and leaned forward to catch a glimpse of his own face in the rear-view mirror. That only made things worse. He smiled exactly like Alfred Ogren's head of research. He recognized the folds around the mouth and the furrows in the forehead, and also the nose, curly hair, everything, even the posture, although the man in the picture was better groomed. The suit was certainly in a different class. Back in his hotel room, Dan kept googling. He lost track of time and swore and shook his head. He was beside himself. They were devastatingly alike. Only the context was different. Leo Mannheimer belonged to another world, another order. He was light years away from Dan, and yet not. It was incomprehensible. Most shattering of all was the music. Dan found an old recording from the Stockholm Concert Hall. Leo was probably 20, perhaps 21, and he looked tense and solemn. The auditorium was full. It was a semi-official performance in which Leo was a guest artist. In those days, no one would have mistaken the one for the other.
Dan was a long-haired bohemian in jeans and sweatshirts, while Leo was already the well-turned-out young man in the Alfred Ogeren portrait, just a bit younger, with the same hairstyle and a similar tailor-made suit. Only the tie was missing. But none of that mattered. When Dan saw the video, his eyes filled with tears. He cried not only because he realized that he had an identical twin, but also for the whole of his lonely life. His childhood on the farm, Sten's beatings and his bullying demands, the work in the fields, the guitar smashed against the jetty, and his escape and journey to Boston and the first months of destitution. He cried for what he had never known, and for everything he had had to do without. But most of all, he cried for what he was hearing. In the end, he took out his guitar and played along. 15 years later, and a world away. It was not only the melancholy piece, apparently composed by Leo himself, but also the melodic bass and harmony. Leo played with the same three-tone arpeggios as Dan did at the time. Just like Dan, he used diminished chords without the flattened fifth, or the minor seventh without the flat ninth, as most of the others did, and he often landed on the seventh tone in the Dorian minor scale. Dan had believed himself to be unique when he came across Django, and found his own path, so remote from all the rock and pop and hip-hop his generation was absorbed in. But now there was a guy in Stockholm, someone who looked exactly like him, who had found the same harmonies and scales in an entirely different kind of world. It was impossible to fathom, and there was so much else bubbling to the surface, longing and hope, maybe love, but above all, sheer wonder. He had a brother. And that brother had grown up with a wealthy family in Stockholm. It was not only extraordinary, it was also deeply unjust. As he recalled later, the anger and the rage set in early, like a pounding force in the midst of everything else. At the time, Dan could not know how this had come about, but he thought about the Stockholm people with their tests, their questions and films. Had they known? Of course they had. He smashed a glass against the wall. Then he looked up Hilda von Kantaborg's number. It was only mid-morning, but Hilda did not sound sober, and that annoyed him. "It's Daniel Brolin," he said. "Do you remember me?"
"What did you say your name was?"
she slurred. "Daniel Brolin." He could hear labored breathing on the other end of the line, and also, he was not sure, he thought he could detect fear.
"Dear Daniel," she said. "Of course. How are you? We were so worried when we didn't hear from you.
Did you know I had an identical twin?
Did you?"
His voice broke. There was silence on the line. Then she poured something into a glass. He understood that she must have known, that this was the whole reason behind the visits to the farm and her strange words, "We are supposed to study, not to intervene."
"Why didn't you say anything?"
Still she did not answer, and he repeated his question more aggressively this time.
"I wasn't allowed to," she managed to whisper. "I had signed confidentiality agreements."
"So some bits of paper were more important than my life?"
"It was wrong, Daniel. Plain wrong. I'm no longer part of the authority. They kicked me out. They didn't like me making objections."
"So it was some fucking authority." His mind was spinning. He had no idea what he was saying. He only remembered her question.
"Have you and Leo found each other?"
Then he lost it completely. It was a while before he realized why. It was the natural tone in which she had referred to him and Leo, as if it was an old familiar notion to her. For him, it was earth-shattering.
"Does he know about this?" "Leo?"
"Yes, Leo!"
"I don't think so, Daniel. I can't say any more. I really can't. I've already said too much."
"Too much? I called you in the middle of a crisis when I had nothing. And what did you say then? Not one word. You let me grow up without knowing the most important thing in my life. You've robbed me—" He struggled for words, but found nothing which would do his feelings justice.
"I'm sorry, Daniel, I'm sorry," she stammered.
He yelled abuse at her, then hung up. He ordered some beer. A whole load of beer. He had to get his nerves under control, because already then it was clear to him that he must get in touch with Leo. But how? Should he write? Call? Simply show up? Leo Mannheimer was different, rich and probably happier and much more sophisticated, and perhaps, Hilda had hinted at the possibility, Leo already knew about him, and had chosen not to get in touch. Perhaps he was ashamed of his poor, downtrodden twin brother. Dan went back to the Alfred Ogren home page and looked again at the picture of Leo. Did those eyes betray a hint of insecurity? That was a small boost. Perhaps Leo was not so cocky after all. He remembered how easy it had been to talk to Julia the night before, and he lapsed into dreams and implausible hopes. He could feel his anger ebbing away and the tears welling up again. What should he do? He googled himself, looking for recordings of his own performances. He came across something from 6 months earlier, when he had just cut his hair and was sitting in a jazz club in San Francisco, playing the solo from Sinatra's All the Things You Are, and using the same sort of melodic bass that Leo had at the Stockholm Concert Hall. He set up the recording as an attachment and wrote a long email. "Dear Leo, dear twin brother, my name is Dan Brody and I'm a jazz guitarist. I was completely unaware of your existence until this morning, and I feel so emotional and shaken that I can hardly write. I don't want to bother you or cause you any inconvenience. I'm not asking for anything, not even a reply. I only want to say, knowing you exist, and knowing that you play the same kind of music as I do, will remain the greatest thing that has ever happened to me. I have no idea if you're interested in my life, in the way that I'm burning with desire to hear about yours, but I want to tell you all the same. Did you ever meet our father? He was a good-for-nothing and a drunk, but he was exceptionally musical. Our mother died giving birth to us. I never found out much about it." Dan wrote 22 pages. But he never sent them. He didn't have the nerve. Instead, he rang Klaus Ganz and told him there had been a death in the family. Then he booked a flight to Stockholm for the following morning. It was the first time in 18 years that he had set foot in Sweden. A cold, piercing wind was blowing. It was snowing. As always at that time in December, the Nobel Prize celebrations were underway. In the streets, the Christmas lights had been switched on, and he looked around in wonder. Stockholm was the great city of his distant childhood memories. He was nervous and feverish, but he was also as eagerly expectant as a little boy. Yet it would still be 5 days before he mustered the courage to take action. Until then, he lived as Leo Mannheimer's invisible shadow, his stalker. Chapter 15. June 21st. Bashir Kazi's beard was long and untidy. He wore khaki trousers and a multi-pocket vest. His arms were thick and muscular. In purely physical terms, he was impressive, but he was slumped on the leather sofa watching television, and having appraised Salander with a condescending look, he ignored her. With any luck, he would be high. She pretended to lurch sideways, steadied herself, and took a slug from her hip flask. Bashir smirked and said to Khalil, "Who's this whore you've dragged home?"
"I've never seen her before. She was just standing outside. She said something about a film we had to see. Get her out of here."
Khalil was frightened of her, it was obvious, but he was more frightened of his brother. That should serve her purpose. She put her bag with a laptop on a chest of drawers by the door.
"And who are you, little girl?" Bashir said.
"No one special," she said.
This did not provoke much of a reaction, but Bashir did at least get to his feet and yawn, presumably to show how bored he was of girls being fresh with him.
"Why did you move back to this part of town?" he said to Khalil. "There's nothing but hookers and crazies here."
Salander looked around. It was a single-room apartment with a small kitchen, sparsely furnished. Apart from the sofa and chest of drawers, there was a loft, bed, and a low table. Clothes were strewn everywhere. A hockey stick was propped against the wall next to the chest.
"That's a pretty sweeping generalization," she said.
"What's that?"
"It's a rather broad generalization, Bashir, wouldn't you say?"
"How come you know my name?"
"I'm just out of prison. Your buddy Benito says hi."
It was a shot in the dark. Or not. She was fairly sure they were in touch with each other, and she saw a spark of recognition in Bashir's watery eyes.
"What's she got to say?"
"It's actually a video clip. Do you want to see?"
"Depends."
"I think you'll enjoy it."
She took out her mobile and fiddled about as if trying to switch it on. But in fact she keyed in some commands and connected to the infrastructure run by Hacker Republic. She took a step forward and looked Bashir in the eye.
"Benito likes to do her friends favours, as you know. But there are a few things that need to be discussed."
"Such as?"
"It's a prison, and that in itself presents a problem. Oh,
By the way, it was pretty clever of you to get a knife into the secure unit. Congratulations.
Get to the point.
The point is Faria.
What about her?
How could you have treated her so badly? You behaved like pigs.
Bashir looked stunned.
What the hell are you saying?
Pigs. Creeps. Bastards. There are many different ways of putting it, all understatements in the circumstances. Don't you think you should be punished?
Salander had expected a reaction, but she had underestimated how violent it would be. The sudden burst of fury after the initial confusion. Without a second's warning, Bashir punched her hard, right on the chin. She only just managed to keep her balance while the rest of her was focused on holding her mobile steady down by her right hip, the screen directed at his face.
"You seem upset," she said.
"Damn fucking right I am!"
Bashir threw another punch, and this time, too, she staggered, but made no effort to defend herself. She didn't even raise her hand. Bashir was staring at her, a combination of rage and astonishment in his eyes. Salander tasted blood. She took a chance.
"Was it really such a good idea to murder Jamal?" she said.
Bashir hit her again, and this time it was harder to stay upright. She felt groggy and shook her head, hoping it would clear her vision. And then she caught sight of Khalil's terrified eyes. Would he attack her too? She could not be sure. It was hard to read him. But more likely he would stay out of it. But there was something pathetic about his scrawny figure.
"Not a good idea after all,"
she said, and looked at Bashir as provocatively as she could. He lost control, just as she had hoped.
"You have no idea what a fucking brilliant idea it was, you slut!"
"Oh, yeah?
He made a whore of Faria,"
Bashir screamed.
"A whore! They dishonored all of us!"
Another blow to the head, and Salander fumbled to keep hold of her mobile.
"So Faria has to die too, doesn't she?"
she stammered.
"Like a rat! A little pig! We won't stop him! She's burning in hell!"
"Okay, now things are becoming clearer," Salander said. "Do you want to see my film?"
"Why the fuck would I?"
"You don't want Benito to be disappointed. That's not a good idea. Surely you know that by now."
Bashir was hesitating. She could tell from his eyes and his twitching arm. But that changed little. He was beside himself with fury, and Salander could not take many more punches. She swiftly measured the distance with her eyes, made a calculation, ran through a chain of consequences. Should she brain him? Knee him in the groin? Strike back? She decided to hold out a little longer, to appear broken, defeated. She did not have to try hard. The next punch came from the side and was heavier than the others. Her upper lip split open and her head boomed. She staggered, almost to her knees.
"Show me now," he growled.
She licked her lips, coughed, spat blood, and collapsed on the leather sofa.
"It's on my mobile," she said.
"Show me!"
Bashir sat next to her. Khalil came closer too. A good thing, she thought. Deliberately, without being too slick, she keyed in the commands and soon the coding appeared on the screen. The brothers became visibly nervous.
"What the hell's happening?" Bashir said. "Is it broken? Is this some sort of crap phone?"
"Oh, no," she said. "This is normal. The film's being loaded into a botnet. And look, now I'm naming the file and using command and control to distribute it."
"What the hell do you mean?"
She could smell rancid sweat.
"Let me explain," she said. "A botnet is a network of hacked computers which have been infected with a virus, a Trojan horse. It's a little bit illegal, but convenient. Before I say more, we should look at the film. I haven't even seen it myself. It's completely unedited. Hold on. Here it is."
Bashir's face appeared on the screen. He looked confused, like a child who doesn't understand a difficult question.
"What the hell's that?"
"You. Unshaven and a bit out of focus. It's hard to film from the hip, but it gets better. More lively. Look. Here you pack a real punch, and now just listen. Sounds like you're confessing to Jamal Chowdhury's murder."
"What the fuck? What the fuck?"
In the film, Bashir was screaming about how Faria would die like a rat, how she would burn in hell. Then it got shaky, and there were more words and punches which were hard to see, a confused sequence of walls and the ceiling.
"What the fuck have you done?"
he yelled, banging his fist on the low table in front of them.
"Just calm down. Take it easy," Salander said. "There's no need to panic."
"What do you mean? Answer me, you bitch!"
Bashir's voice cracked.
"A significant majority of the world's population hasn't yet gotten the film," Salander said. I'd say barely more than 100 million people have received it, and I'll bet most of them will think it's spam and delete it right away. But I did have time to name it. I called it Bashir Kazi. Your friends will probably want to have a look, and the police, of course, and Seppo, and your friends' friends, and so on. It might even go viral, you never know. The net's such a crazy place. I've never really got my head around it.
Bashir looked deranged. His head jerked this way and that.
I can see this is tough for you, Salander said. Publicity's never easy to handle. I can remember the first time I had my name all over the papers. I still haven't gotten over it, to be honest. But the good news is, there's a way out.
How?
I'll tell you. I just have to...
Lightning quick, and taking advantage of his bewilderment and desperation, she grabbed hold of his head and smashed it twice onto the tabletop in front of them. Then she stood up.
You can run, Bashir, she said. You can run so fast that your disgrace won't catch up with you.
Bashir stared at her, rooted to the spot. His right arm shook. He put his hands to his forehead.
It might work, she went on. Not for long, but for a little while. If you run and run, like your brother, maybe not as fast, you're getting flabby, aren't you? I'm sure you'll be able to stagger on somehow or other.
I'm going to kill you, Bashir said.
He leaped up and made as if to throw himself at her, but then hesitated and looked nervously at the front door and windows.
What are you waiting for? Salander said. You need to get going.
I will find you, he hissed.
I'll be seeing you again, then, she said in a cold monotone.
She turned and took a step towards the chest of drawers, giving him every chance to attack her from behind. But he was as dumbfounded and helpless as she had anticipated. At that moment, his mobile rang.
Maybe it's someone who saw the film. But it's all cool, right? Just don't pick up and keep your head down when you're out, she said.
Bashir cursed and came at her, but Salander grabbed the hockey stick from against the wall and hit him as hard as she could in the throat, face, and stomach.
This is from Faria, she said.
Bashir doubled over and took another hit, but managed to straighten up. With unsteady steps, he stumbled through the door, down the dark stairwell, out into the afternoon sun. Salander stood, holding the hockey stick. Khalil Kazi was behind her by the sofa, his eyes flitting back and forth, his mouth hanging open. A teenager still, with a wiry, slight body, he looked terrified. He was hardly a threat to anyone, but he might flee and begin to unravel. Giannini had mentioned a risk of suicide. Salander kept her eye on the door and glanced at her watch. It was 4:20 in the afternoon. She checked her emails. Neither Bublansky nor Farah Sharif had answered. Giannini had written, "Excellent. Looks promising. Go home right now." She looked at Khalil, who was breathing heavily. He seemed to want to say something.
"It's you, isn't it?" he said.
"Who?"
"The woman in the papers."
She nodded.
"You and I have another film to look at. This one's less exciting. It's mostly hand movement."
She propped the hockey stick against the wall, took the bag with her laptop from the chest of drawers, and motioned to Khalil to sit on the sofa. He was pale and looked as if his legs might give way, but he did as he was told. She gave him a brief factual account of movement recognition and deep neural networks. She told him she had filmed his run earlier, and about the CCTV and the tunnel banner. He muttered something inaudible, and she knew at once, by the way his body stiffened, that he had understood. She sat down next to him and opened the files on her laptop. As they watched, she tried to explain, but he did not seem to be taking any of it in. For a long time he stared blankly at the screen, and then his mobile rang. He looked at her.
"Go ahead and answer it," she said.
Khalil picked up, and it was obvious from the formality in his voice that he was speaking to someone for whom he had the greatest respect. His imam was in the neighbourhood, that must have been Annika Giannini's doing, and he was asking if he could join them. Salander nodded. That might be a good idea. Confessions were more the imam's province anyway. A short while later there was a knock at the door. A tall, elegant man stepped into the apartment. He was in his 50s and had a long beard and a red turban. He nodded to Salander and then turned to Khalil with a melancholy smile.
"Hello, my boy," he said. "You and I can talk in peace now."
His voice was heavy with sorrow, and for a moment there was silence. Salander felt uncomfortable, all of a sudden unsure what she should do.
"I don't think it's safe here," she said. "I suggest you leave. Get yourselves to the mosque."
She took her laptop and bag and left them without saying goodbye, disappearing into the dark stairwell. December, 1.5 years earlier. Dan Brody sat on a bench in Norrmalmstory. It was his first day back in Stockholm. The sky was clear, the air cold, and he was wearing a scruffy black coat with a white fake fur collar, sunlight.